From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for Market Watch, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. Our moderator is Washington journalist Michael Warren.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. A funding standoff between President Trump and congressional Democrats means the government shutdown is about to enter its third week. Backroom dealing, dueling national addresses, and even a trip to the border by President Trump did not seem to change things. We'll discuss what may be coming next. Another round of trade talks between the United States and China wrapped up this week in Beijing. Both governments sounded optimistic about progress made, but also said there is still much more to be resolved. Will the pause in trade warfare between the two nations continue? The United States continues with its plans to withdraw its military presence in Syria. Two of President Trump's top foreign policy advisors were in the Middle East, but questions about the future of that withdrawal and the U.S. fight against terrorist groups there remain uncertain. And one of those advisors, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, delivered a speech in Cairo this week, sharply criticizing the anti-terrorism policy of the Obama administration and laying out a competing vision. We'll return to the Middle East, but first let's talk about what's going on here in Washington. Steve, bring us up to speed about where the now three-week-old government shutdown is. You have a fight between President Trump and congressional Democrats in the House over the funding of a border wall. Did anything get resolved this week?
Well, absolutely nothing got resolved this week. I think what you're seeing is really a fight by the president to preserve his base. I think it's useful to go back to when this happened and why it happened. Congressional Republicans were more than happy to fund the government, as they have for the last 2 years since Trump has been in office. But then Trump started getting pushback, really from conservative media, people like Rush Limbaugh, Ann Coulter. And that's when Trump dug in and really insisted that he get funding for the wall. And we've been at this impasse ever since. And for their part, congressional Democrats who have in the past voted for some barriers on the southern border are refusing to fund anything. So the amount of money, the $5.7 billion, is in the scheme of what Congress spends every year absolutely insignificant. But it's a symbolic debate, and both sides have dug in, and we don't right now have much movement.
And there is so much symbolism, Tom, in this fight here. Again, I think as Steve points out, for 2 years, the Republican president had a Republican, unified Republican Congress where something could have been done, something could have been built. But then add on to the fact that President Trump, when he was campaigning for office, and even since he's been in office, has claimed that not the United States taxpayer, but in fact Mexico would somehow pay for this wall. Now he's asking Congress, as Steve pointed out, Democrats, some of whom have voted for border wall funding in the past, now seem to be saying if Trump is for it, we're going to be unified against it. What is the way out here for both sides and for getting everybody with something coming away with something that they want?
Well, one way out, Michael, would be, and I'm not taking sides with the Democrats at all, because I think some of their strategy is not particularly straight or honest. But I think the Democratic solution, which is let's set aside the wall because we are at such loggerheads, we are so fundamentally at odds on this issue, let's set that aside, let's fund the rest of the government and agree to keep talking about this, meaning the whole fight about the wall. And President Trump has said, forget about it. And the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, has said, I'm not sending anything to the White House that the president won't sign. And the president is as dug in and intransigent as the Democrats. So you have this situation. At some point, I think there will be, and I think it might be sooner rather than later. I don't think this is going to go on for months and maybe even years, as some have suggested. But at some point, the misery index of the average American federal worker who can't meet mortgages, who can't do all sorts of things, I think that will finally have an impact on both sides, and they'll come to an agreement. But I don't think it's going to happen in the next handful of days, but you never know.
Steve, the president went down to the border on Thursday, again, in an attempt to make the case that the border wall was something that that needed to be funded and needed to be funded right now. Polls show that the president's getting more blame now. It was somewhat evenly split between the Democrats and the White House. Now the president's getting more blame for this shutdown. Is he losing the public relations battle on this wall issue?
I think he is losing the public relations battle, but it's also important to think about what is Trump's broader strategy. And I do think for Trump, he felt that his base was starting to slip away. And in some ways, I think, and you can see it in this debate right now over the funding, that for the president, losing the base is much worse than losing on one kind of broader issue with the public. I think his 2020 strategy is very simple. Have his base fired up and then try to poke holes in the Democratic candidate, whoever that is. Certainly Elizabeth Warren is somebody he's already attacked, and to raise enough doubts that they come back to Trump. That is his broader strategy. I think we see that in a lot of different moves that he makes. And so as long as he has his base, I don't get the sense that he particularly is moved to fold. And he's dug in on this issue more than he has on a lot of other ones.
I think that's right. But it's a political issue is what Steve is saying. Now that seems, Tom, that it could extend into what we expect the president might do, or the president's sort of laying the groundwork for, which is issuing an emergency, national emergency declaration about the border and building the wall with emergency funds. Does that continue the political effort that Steve argues the president is pursuing?
Yes, it would. If you first have an argument about whether he has the authority to do that. And the President Trump has said he has the, quote, absolute authority to do that. That's subject to some debate, and you can be sure that would get to the Supreme Court in a matter of several weeks to a couple of months. But you might be able to have a situation where you set that piece of it aside, whether the national emergency is constitutional or unconstitutional, and then in the meantime open the government. Where Trump can say, hey, I've done everything I can. But the Democrats are also emboldened because, as Steve suggested, the polls show the people, a majority of the American people, one, don't want a wall, and two, don't think there's a national emergency at the border. And so you have this kind of, at the moment, seemingly intractable conflict here.
Well, as one conflict heats up, this one in trade in that realm seems to be calming down a little bit. Both the United States and China were in Beijing this week. Trade representatives from both of those countries having talks, issuing statements afterward, Steve saying they had positive movement, progress towards some kind of resolution for this now almost two-year-long sort of protracted trade battle. But both countries also said there's a lot more to be done. What did we learn about what happened in Beijing this week, and is there going to be any real significant resolution to these trade battles?
Well, I think what we have learned is that both sides feel a pressure to keep continuing the talks. That, I think, is really the takeaway, that there's nothing that happened in Beijing that either side said was, you know, what you've gone too far. And if you look at the outline of what Presidents Trump and Xi agreed in Argentina, and there's actually disputes from the two sides on what they actually agreed even. But what seemed to have happened in this last week was focus on some of the easier issues. For example, China buying some U.S. commodities, things like soybeans, some of the various energy products that the U.S. exports. That never really was the heart of the contention between the talks, which really relies on things like China allegedly stealing U.S. intellectual property, the Chinese requirements for joint ventures, that major companies like General Motors, for whom China is now their largest market, have to be in 50-50 ventures. So on these really thorny issues, there hasn't been really any substantive breakthrough. But I do think both sides have really want to keep talking. It matters. I mean, the China economy has slowed down markedly. The U.S. financial markets have been very turbulent. And so both sides want to show progress. And financial markets loved it in the last week. And we had a continued rally in the stock market.
And there's, I think, some question about political markets here. What Steve mentioned, the agreement for China to start buying again soybeans and other agricultural commodities, has got to be calming down people in the heartland. Voters, many of who for President Trump in 2016, who were understandably getting nervous, Tom, about what was happening to prices for their products. Politically, this seems like it could be a minor win for the administration here in the United States to sort of calm down a part of their political base. What say you?
I agree with that, Michael. The other thing I think is pretty clear is President Trump and his advisors are keenly aware of the correlation between the state of the Sino-American talks on trade and the stock market. And I think that's one reason why there was an agreement to keep talking at least until March 1st. And the markets stabilized a bit at that point. Basically, when it looks like China and the United States are going to go into a trade war, the market tanks. And when it looks like it's better, or at least they're talking, the market stabilizes or goes back up. I mean, I wasn't surprised at all in the last week or so. President Trump put out a couple tweets saying good progress in the talks without specifying what that progress was, which you wouldn't expect him to. But so they're both sides are very sensitive about that. And of course, I think if they cut a deal, which will require, I think, more compromise than either side is ready to agree to, at least publicly at the moment, the markets will do better here. And if they don't, we're going to see more roller coaster plunges.
But it does suggest a bit of trench warfare when it comes to this trade battle, if the commodities issue is really the only one that's been resolved. And as Steve mentioned, those issues of intellectual property theft that the United States is making against China remain unresolved. Well, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more issues.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then, like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now, back to our panel, Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for Market Watch, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal. Our moderator is Washington journalist Michael Warren.
Well, two top Trump national security and foreign policy advisors were in the Middle East, but both of them had sort of different experiences. Tom, let's start with John Bolton, the national security advisor in the White House, the top national security advisor to the president, traveling to the Middle East and ending his trip in Turkey, where he had sort of a difficult time with the president of Turkey there, Recep Erdogan, on the eve of the American withdrawal of troops from Syria. Tell us what exactly happened there, and what did John Bolton want to achieve, and did he achieve it?
Well, I don't think he achieved it, at least at the moment, Michael. He was hoping to reach an agreement with Erdogan that he would back down from his threats to obliterate the Kurds in Syria, who he has always thought are terrorists.
And in Turkey in particular, the Kurdish
the Kurds
population
in Turkey,
there.
And he believes the Kurds, who have been fighting with the American coalition in Syria, are an adjunct of the Kurds in Turkey. And he and his government have said as soon as the U.S. gets out of Turkey, we're going to go after them and wipe them out. And that did not go down well with some in the United States. And so on top of which, there's the president's decision to get out of Turkey sooner rather than later has prompted a lot of criticism in the United States, especially among some conservative Republicans. And so Bolton was hoping to get Erdogan to stand down. But at least at the moment, Erdogan refused to receive him. There were, quote, scheduling conflicts.
Right.
And Erdogan is still angry about the notion that he's supposed to stand down. And also Bolton is trying to get support within the region for a gradual pullout of American troops from Syria. Although not long before we came to these microphones, there was a U.S. government notification that the drawdown from Syria by the U.S. has begun.
That's
so
right.
It's all over the place. So Bolton was not successful in the primary goal of getting Erdogan to behave like an adult.
Well, and it seems that he was also unsuccessful at convincing his own administration, the administration he works for that gradual withdrawal. There was a pledge or an argument from Bolton to Erdogan saying, we will only withdraw troops from Syria if we get this pledge from you. And at the same time he was doing this, the president was preparing, President Trump, that is, was preparing for this now ongoing withdrawal of American troops. There seems to be a fight, Steve, within the administration, not just among conservative Republicans in Washington who disagree with the president on this withdrawal, but even within the administration. We saw James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, resign and, in fact, was essentially pushed out early from his position that most reports suggest was over this question of Syria withdrawal. Is he losing allies even within his own administration over this kind of action, even as he gains allies among some non-interventionists, say Rand Paul, senator from the Republican Party, who agrees with him?
Well, I always thought that there's been a very rocky coalition within the Trump White House on issues of foreign policy and really the defense military establishment in particular. I think Trump's own instincts are very isolationist. You just mentioned Senator Paul, who I think Trump kind of at his heart kind of agrees with that. He, during the campaign, made the somewhat ludicrous claim that he was against the Iraq war. That seemed to be after the fact. But nonetheless, I think Trump always has had suspicion toward the Pentagon and toward U.S. involvement overseas. And so that you have his own instincts. But of course, he has to draw his advisors from somewhere. And the Republican ones that he tends to draw from tend to favor a more interventionist approach. And that's why I do think you have this kind of seemingly contradictory policy play out. It's absolutely playing out in Syria, where it's tough to follow, you know, what our broader policy is. And you had Trump making a very swift announcement that the U.S. was withdrawing, and are they withdrawing or not? Nobody. It's tough to find out. So I think the broader context is he's always had a rocky coalition. You know, somebody like James Mattis never was, let's say, a total Trump person to begin with. And I think we're going to find this sort of contradictory policy in other foreign policy issues that come up over the remaining 2 to 6 years.
Well, it seems to me, Tom, that that sort of disconnect between the president himself and the advisors he surrounds himself with extends obviously into Afghanistan as well, where the president was opposed to the United States' continued presence in Afghanistan. And yet it was just last year that the president continued and even expanded American military presence there at the advice of another general, H.R. McMaster, who was then his national security advisor. The president seems to be almost preparing as well to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. That disconnect, again, as Steve points out, seems to be a real problem, because who will be left in Washington for the president to rely on for advice?
It really is a problem for him, Michael. I was struck by Congresswoman Liz Cheney from Wyoming, who is now not just the daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney, one of the more profound hawks in recent, is publicly criticized the president for getting out of Syria. She said that's a wrong decision. And I hope he reconsiders it. Well, we thought he was reconsidering it, but now he may be reconsidering his reconsideration. When you have a hawk, a super hawk, like Liz Cheney, the number three Republican in the House, that should give somebody pause within the Trump administration. The bottom line is there's not a lot of coherence at the moment, and it's got to get sorted out.
Well, one advisor who the president does seem to be at the moment listening to and relying on heavily is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, a long time within this administration, at least, ally of the president when he was CIA director, giving daily in-person briefings at the White House. Now as Secretary of State, seems to be somebody the president relies on and trusts. Pompeo was in Cairo and other parts of the Middle East this week, but in Cairo he gave a speech sharply criticizing the Obama administration's policy toward anti-terrorism. Steve, this was a symbolic place for the Secretary of State to give a speech. Can you tell us why?
Well, it's where President Obama very famously gave articulated his vision of the Middle East shortly after becoming president. And it's, you know, I think whatever that vision of Obama was, and if you look at the Middle East right now, you can't say that President Obama was particularly successful implementing it. What was unusual was to see a Secretary of State so directly take on a previous U.S. administration. And it really felt more like a partisan speech in Congress, which, of course, is Pompeo's background, than one intended for a foreign audience. And besides his articulation of anti-Iran policy, which I think did get fell on receptive ears to his audience, certainly Egypt and Saudi Arabia both share their concerns, there really wasn't too much of substance for the Middle East to rely on. And in fact, it seems to be almost counter to the policy his boss is pursuing. He articulated a very strong presence in the United States in the region, made it seem like they were going to be doing more when everything we see seems to be going the opposite direction. And President Trump wants to pull back from the region. So I do wonder who the audience was, if it really was for the rest of the Middle East, or if Pompeo was just talking to his boss through the lens of, hey, I'm as against President Obama as you are, but maybe this is what we should be doing in the Middle East and not what you're saying.
That's right. I experienced some dissonance listening to Pompeo's speech, particularly the way, unsurprising given Pompeo and the President Trump's own stated opposition to the current regime in Iran. But to have this happening, Tom, at the same time that the United States is withdrawing from Syria, Syria being led by the Assad regime, which is essentially a client state of Iran, and seen very much this withdrawal in the region as giving a win not just to Russia, which is also playing a much bigger role in the region, but also to Iran. Speak to Steve's point. I thought it's a very interesting one that this the intended audience for this may have been the president himself.
Well, not just the president himself, but once again, the president's base. This is the sort of thing his base needs to be reassured about, because many in his base, as we've suggested earlier, are a little worried about the pullback in Syria and a possible pullback from Afghanistan. I think Pompeo was playing to his boss, but also saying to his base, we will remain engaged. We are virulently anti-Iranian and we'll do what we need to do. And so it had a dual purpose. I mean, I don't think this is the smartest bunch of advisors I've ever seen around a president. I've been covering presidents since the last months of Lyndon B. Johnson. But Pompeo gets an exemption there. He's very smart. He knows what he's doing, whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing. He's not a freelancer. So I think this speech was far more than just dump on Obama. I mean, the Trump people have done that since long before President Trump was president. That just shouldn't surprise anybody. But this was a message to hardliners in the region, and also a message to hardliners in President Trump's base.
Well, it's an interesting study of contrasts between Pompeo, who again has the trust and the ear of the president, and John Bolton, who, before he entered the White House, was very much had the president's ear very early on in the administration. When John Bolton was writing columns, they would frequently end up on President Trump's desk and influence his decisions with regard to Iran. Very quickly, Steve, John Bolton seems to be, since he's entered the White House, on the way out, or at least on the outs with President Trump, losing all of these battles on Syria and otherwise. Can anybody work for this president for very long without being pushed away?
I would say the short answer is no, but it goes back to that broader conflict. Trump entered office with a vision of how he wanted to operate that really was inconsistent with, really, I would say, the talent pool of what you would typically look to for Republican administrations. There aren't any, let's say, nationalist think tanks in Washington. They just don't exist. You'll have some overlap with various parts of the Republican Party. But basically, he brought his own vision, and he doesn't really have the depth to carry it out. And that's why you keep seeing these really back and forth on a number of issues and inconsistencies. And I think that will continue.
Well, we'll continue covering those here on Issues in the News, but that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Washington journalist Michael Warren.